Network.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We all want to be happy, but what does it mean to be truly happy? And what can we do to bring more happiness into our lives and the lives of those around us? Here to share her insights on happiness is Sarah Van Gelder, the lead editor of a new book, Sustainable Happiness, Live Simply, Live Well, Make a Difference. Sarah is the co-founder and executive editor-in-chief of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org, which feature powerful ideas and practical actions towards a more just and sustainable world. Yes Magazine covers issues ranging from community resilience to prison alternatives, from a cooperative economy to sustainable happiness. Sarah's earlier book is titled This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement. Sarah co-founded a co-housing community, built a produce cooperative, and worked with the Shukamish tribe, the tribe of Chief Seattle, on securing the return of his home, now the Old Man House State Park. Sarah lives on a Native American reservation with the Suquamish people and serves on the board of the tribe's foundation. She joins us now from her office at Yes Magazine. Sarah Van Gelder, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Eleanor.
It's a great pleasure. I love your book, I have to say. This is really great. So
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yes. Your new book is called Sustainable Happiness. So tell us, what is sustainable happiness and where does real happiness come from?
Well, a lot of the self-help books that are out there on happiness talk all about what you can do as an individual. And some of the advice is actually quite good. But what they leave out is that we are people, we are beings who live in relationship to our families, to our communities, to even the natural systems of the world. And that we can only really be happy if those relationships are in good shape and if all of those other people that we relate to or living systems that we relate to are also doing well. So sustainable happiness is about that kind of happiness. It's about the kind of happiness that sustains over the long term because it's built on those foundations which are so basic to who we are and what brings about real well-being.
That's good. And I think, you know, there's a lot of great work, as you say, in the self-help books. I mean, in addition to leaving out relationships with people and nature, it also leaves out systemic change and how kind of the whole decisions made by our government, decisions made in our economy shape what our individual choices might be. So we need to look at both the individual and the social.
Exactly.
Which I think
your
book does well.
Yes, we look at that in depth. Things like, what does it mean to have a society that enhances well-being? What if we measured well-being instead of the size of the economy or the growth of the economy? Because it turns out those two aren't the same things. We can have an economy that grows rapidly, but well-being of ordinary people doesn't go up. So why is that? And what would it mean if we had an economy that served people instead of the other way around?
Right, exactly. And one of the core parts of your book, you know, you're talking about sustainable happiness, as you say, coming from loving relationships, thriving communities, both our natural communities and our human communities, meaningful work, and a few simple practices like gratitude. So, and I know that that's true, but so why do we think that buying more stuff and having more money will make us happy?
Well, it's interesting. There was actually a conscious effort launched by some business leaders and Freudian psychologists back in the 1920s to develop a set of messages about how important it was for us to buy stuff. this came about back during a period when a lot of business leaders and even government leaders were worried that the economy was going to stall if Americans basically felt like they had enough stuff and they weren't going to go out buying lots and lots more stuff, that they were just going to basically be happy with what they have. So they actually invented the modern advertising industry by bringing in what was then a new ideas about Freudian psychology, which would tell them how to link our deepest desires for love and companionship and sex and status and all the other things that are basic to who we are, to link those to the notion that we have to buy stuff in order to get those things. So that industry has been enormously successful. They spend billions of dollars every year working to convince us of those things. And even if kids are seeing, 50 to 70 ads on television every day, even if they don't necessarily, or adults for that matter, don't necessarily buy into the specific products that are being sold, the worldview, the values that underlie those messages are very strong, and it's all about over and over and over again, you need to have this or buy this or use money to get this other thing or you can't be happy. And it does have an impact that money is being spent effectively.
Yeah, well, we've got the advertisers now. They got the message. They're spending billions of dollars to make us think that buying stuff will make us happy. It's worked successfully. So, it leads me to two questions, kind of going in different directions. But one question is, given that there are billions of dollars spent to make us, linking our deepest desires with buying stuff, how do we overcome that conditioning? And then kind of a separate but connected question is, weren't they right in the 1920s? If people do buy less stuff, won't it mean that the economy won't be so thriving?
Okay, so those are two big questions.
Right.
The first one, what do we do about that in our personal lives, about that message? I think a lot of it is just stepping back and realizing we have choices. So especially this time of year, there's so much hype about what we're going to be giving away for Christmas and what we're going to be getting for Christmas. And we can make choices that's not the most important thing to us. What's most important to us may be spending time with family or going to see some music or, having a special quiet day, with people you love. There's so many things that when we step back from all the hype, and really think about it and talk to the people we care about, that those other things come clear, that the things that really do bring us joy and well-being. And especially at the new year, it's a great time to be thinking about that, to be really asking yourself, where have I gotten the most satisfaction? Where do I know that I'm contributing the most to the well-being of those that I love? A really good question to ask yourself if you're trying to work that one through is the perennial question about, if I was on my deathbed looking back at my life, what would I wish I had more of or done more of? And what would I not care about or wish I had done less of? And very few people, I think, will say, I wish I'd done more shopping. I think, when it comes down to it.
My daughter probably would, but I my daughter is a champion shopper. But you're so right about this time of year. We're all kind of going crazy, making a list, checking it twice, figuring out what to buy, people going hither and yon, chasing sales, chasing more stuff. And this year, it seems it started earlier than ever. I noticed stuff going up at Halloween. I mean, it used to be at Thanksgiving the whole gift-buying push would come on, but this year it started at Halloween, so it gives more time to kind of build up the frenzy. But I think, you're right. The bigger picture is, what are we going to really enjoy? And it just struck me the other day as I was running around gift-buying going, wait a minute, just stop. The whole point of the whole season is to express gratitude for people and, give a surprise, something that might improve someone's life, might delight them in the moment, something they might enjoy. But it's really not about the stuff. It's about the personal connection.
That's right. One of my favorite gifts that I got a few years back when my kids were young, they gave me a Happy Mommy book, which was made up of coupons of things that they would do for me, like take a bath without whining or like helping me with some yard work, and And they drew these little illustrations for each one. And I so appreciate that gift. That's one that I remember, and actually I keep looking back on it. And some of the other gifts that someone went out to the store and bought, you know, those just don't have that kind of meaning. So that
right.
kind of simplicity, the things that you can do together or that sort of speak to the relationship you have with somebody, those, you know, and have some fun and humor built in, those, I think those are the things that people really look back on with that kind of pleasure.
I love the Happy Mommy book. I'm going to suggest that to my daughter. She might appreciate with 1 week to go to Christmas.
Right. So it's kind of a DIY version. And one other thing to think about when you're sort of making that reflection on, you know, what really is valuable to you, is that whatever spiritual tradition, if any, that you come from, you know, if you look deeply at the teachings of that tradition, almost all of them suggest that that materialism is a distraction, that getting caught up in stuff is a distraction from the deeper work and the deeper satisfaction that we have access to. If not, the spiritual traditions, probably your grandmother would have told you to count your blessings. And, you know, those are really good pieces of advice that have held up over the millenniums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that whole approach, and thank you for the reminder, particularly in this season. So now to the other big question, you know, as much as we are concerned about the money we spend, the effort and energy in our lives that goes into buying stuff and paying it off and working, carrying the debt burden, all of that stuff that we wouldn't have to carry in our lives, that stress that would be reduced if we would buy less, but at the same time, if we all follow this advice and buy less, that will definitely impact the economy. Businesses will sell less. People will lose jobs. And won't the economy go in that tailspin they were worried about in the 1920s?
Well, it's interesting because the other option that people were advocating for back during that time period was, instead of us all, as you say, working more and buying more, and also, by the way, they weren't talking about this then, but we certainly need to be aware of this now. That involves churning through the world's resources, churning through the rainforest and the oceans.
Ripping up the planet in order to buy those Christmas gifts.
That's right. Ripping up the planet. And some of those are wounds that will not heal easily, if at all. So, you know, that's a very unsustainable way to run an economy. So the other thing that they were advocating at the time was the notion that people would work less and that they would spend less and that they would spend more of their time doing things like reading to their children or, you know, being part of community groups or taking classes. One of the best examples of this, which has been written up by a guy named Honeycutt, is about what happened at the Kellogg Company when they decided during the Depression, they decided that they could keep a lot more people employed by going to six-hour shifts instead of eight-hour shifts. So they'd actually, by dividing the 24-hour day into six-hour shifts, you'd be able to employ an entire additional shift of workers and spread the work around. And they did that
during the Depression, or when did they do that?
Yeah, that was during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that, first of all, that people were far more productive because they weren't so tired and dragging by the end of their shifts. So they actually were able, in the end, to pay the same amount for 6 hours of work that they had been paying for 8 hours of work. And they did succeed in spreading more work around, so more people had jobs. And the entire community flourished because, you know, for the women especially loved it because they could be at home with their kids when the kids got home from school, or they could be taking classes, or they could be involved in the community. And the community became so much more alive. And people write in their journals, you know, his studies show the kinds of things people were writing about and how, you know, they were doing things like canning produce together or growing a garden. And so when you start thinking about an economy that's not all focused on go to work, work yourself to exhaustion and come home and throw some dinner in the microwave because you don't have enough energy left to cook, if you start reorienting it so we can take back some of our time to spend at home with our community and with our community, we can do things for ourselves. We can grow some more of our own food and gardens if that's what we enjoy doing. We can make things ourselves. We can do that together with our children so they have that experience of being with adults who love them and have time for them.
That sounds kind of idyllic. So why aren't we doing it?
Well, we're not doing it because that kind of economy doesn't result in as much profit for the big corporations. You know, it's kind of like the way that the gross domestic product is measured. If we, you know, if we work really hard and we buy lots of microwave dinners and send our kids to daycare, that's good for the economy because more money changes hands. But if we work fewer hours and take care more of our kids' time ourselves and make dinner from scratch, according to the GDP, that's bad for the economy because not so much money is changing hands. We're more frugal. So it's not necessarily that it creates unemployment. Again, if we cut back on our hours, we can share around the work that there is. It's that you know, that it's a more mixed economy. It's an economy in which, or I should say society, in which we have more options of how we spend our time. And some of those options are far more enriching to us, even if they generate less profit for the corporations.
Yeah. You know, it sounds great. And I'm thinking as you're talking, we're kind of going in the opposite direction now, because if you look since 2008, the so-called recovery, 95% of the increased money in the recovery has gone to the top 1%. So, you know, most people are still stuck back in where the jobs were lost and, you know, pay sluggish back from the 2008 deep recession. And as a consequence, people are now working, you know, maybe two jobs, sometimes three jobs, in order to pay the rent and buy food for the family. So we're, instead of moving towards less time, because so much of the money is going up to the top 1%, people are actually spending more time at work. So what can we do in that situation?
Yeah, I agree with you that's in fact what is happening. And, you know, one subset of that is that the increases in productivity that come about with more technology, the benefits of that are all going to the top 1%. They used to be more widely shared as workers created more stuff and more wealth. That used to be more widely shared with them, so their incomes went up, and that's not happening anymore in
right.
our economy.
Right. The increases in productivity are all going to the owners, not to the workers.
Exactly. So that's keeping most people either poor or precarious in terms of whether they can have a standard of living they can rely on. So what can we do about it? Well, the reasons that is happening is in part because of the rules of how our economy functions, and those rules are created in a democratic society by the people we elect. So that's one of the questions, is how do we get different kinds of rules? You know, one of the big examples of that is the way that the banks function and as part of the Wall Street system and speculate with our money. And when they make a lot of money, they keep it. And when they lose a lot of money, the taxpayers bail them out. And that's ordinary people like you and me. So, you know, those are rules that are created in Washington, D.C., and the people who create those kinds of rules or tolerate them are accountable to us. So that's one of the ways we get at it, is by insisting that our elected officials, and by the way, this is not just Republicans or just Democrats who are responsible. Both parties have substantial numbers who do basically whatever the corporations want them to do. I think one of the things we need to look at is whether that partisan divide is really distracting us from the more realistic divide, which is between those who are subsumed in the corporate agenda versus those who are really populists. So that's part of it. Another part of it is to make choices in our own lives to the degree that we can, to find ways to do things ourselves, take care of one another in our communities, buy less stuff so that we're less dependent on that money economy that, that corporations control. There's some things that we can do at the local level in our own lives, and building a local economy that supports the mom-and-pop businesses, the people who are committed to our communities, that looks at ways of shifting some production from what the big corporations are doing to what, for example, cooperatives can do. So there's a lot of different levels we can be working on. But it is daunting because so much of the financial resources and power in our society now are controlled by those big corporations.
Right. You know, it's interesting for me. I remember seeing a show with Oprah Winfrey once, and she did a worldwide analysis on happiness. And the number one, I don't know if you saw this in your research, the number one country that came out the happiest country on earth by however they were measuring it was Denmark. So Oprah Winfrey went to Denmark and talked to the people there. And the bottom line of the whole thing was that they focused on having less stuff and more time. So the apartments they live in are much smaller. They don't have all the furniture. They don't have all the clothes and the toys. And with having less stuff, they don't have to work so much. They don't have to earn so much. They have less debt. They have more time to be with their family, to go to the park. I mean, it just sounded like such a great way to do it. And so maybe that's a possible model for the kind of happiness you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, and one other part of that is they also bicycle. A lot of them bicycle.
Right.
And if you think of the difference between bicycling and driving a car, you know, if you bicycle, you're spending far less money. You're getting exercise as part of your everyday routine instead of making it a special trip, which is, you know, easy to miss to go to the gym or to work out. And you're also much more involved in your community because you're outside with people instead of sort of cordoned off in your own little shell of a car. So there's all these ways that bicycling makes people happier and healthier, and Denmark is certainly at the forefront of that by again, you know, there are policies that make that work better, you know, bike lanes and safe ways that people can get from here to there on their bikes where they're not out in the middle of traffic and terrified of whether they're going to be able to survive the trip.
Right. No, exactly. Well, I know, you know, and most of our listeners know I live in Washington, D.C. Someone has to be on the front lines here. And there are many things you can be critical of in Washington, D.C., but one of the great advances we've had in recent years is the focus on more bicycling, that we're getting more bike lanes in there. And not only are the bike lanes made, but they're actually being used. More people are biking. I know recently when you were visiting, you saw you can just rent a bike for a short period of time, and people are using them, and more of the young people moving into Washington, D.C. don't own a car. First of all, there's nowhere to park, so that's a good thing to not have a car for many reasons, including that. But just saying, I don't even have a license. I don't drive. I want a bicycle. I want to use public transportation. I want to walk. And it's enabled the city to welcome a lot of young people coming in who don't add to the congestion and the pollution, but you know, they're out there, they're exercising, they're healthier, and you know, it's wonderful to see the transformation in the city because of the increased bicycling.
Yes, I saw that too. It was very exciting. And our current issue of Yes Magazine is on cities that are doing all sorts of innovative things like that, like places you wouldn't expect, Chicago and New York, you know, with those kinds of bike share programs, and also with huge, now many miles of dedicated bike lanes. So yeah, cities can relatively quickly make themselves far more bike friendly. You know, it's actually a fairly quick way to make a pretty significant improvement in both the ecological sustainability, because of course all those people aren't polluting, as well as the health and well-being of people across the income spectrum.
So change is possible, and in fact, change is happening. I want to talk about the fact that you live on a reservation with the Suquamish tribe, and what has your connection with Native Americans taught you about happiness?
Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting is that the tradition of the coastal Salish tribes is one of the most important ceremonies is the potlatch, in which people give away a lot of things. And so, you know, I've been looking at that for a while and thinking about that, because every society, it's very easy for one segment of the population to accumulate more wealth and power, because if you have a little bit more wealth and power, then you can kind of rejigger the rules and rejigger the relationships until you have still more wealth and power, and it just sort of feeds on itself until you end up with these incredibly unequal situations. Well, in the coastal Salish traditions, if you have some sense of authority or some wealth, one of the things you're expected to do is to hold a potlatch and give away a tremendous amount to other people. So there's this constant flow of giveaways, of essentially redistribution, that's all just built right into the culture. So that's one thing I've learned is how much happiness is generated through that kind of just generosity, just enormous generosity that is just a constant part of life in this community.
Yeah, well, I think that's really good. And one of the things I liked about your book, Sustainable Happiness, is you're looking at some scientifically based assessment of what makes people happier. And I was surprised to learn that when people give something away, they actually tend to be happier than when they buy something for themselves.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And if I could just say for your listeners where they can, if they want to learn more about the book, we have a sample chapter at yesmagazine.org, so they can learn more about the Sustainable Happiness book there. Yeah, it's so interesting. This weekend I ran into this woman who discovered that I had put one of these little free libraries in my front yard, you know, where neighbors put their books and other people take them. And it was so interesting because I thought she might say, oh, and I found this wonderful book to read there. But what she said was, I put a book in there and somebody took it. And she was so happy because a week, you know, she'd put her book in there and a week later it was gone. And that meant somebody had taken it and read it. And it was, she just said this over and over again, somebody took it.
The joy of giving.
Yeah, that was just such a lovely thing to see her say. And I kept waiting for her to say, and I got a good book too, but it wasn't that. It was that somebody took the book she had given, and it was an anonymous person, so she hadn't even been thanked. You know, mm-hmm. But she still
got
such
pleasure. It's
out there in the world, and she did it. She contributed that.
You're inspiring me. I think, you know, we have some of those free library, free book giveaways. And, you know, people do it. They look like bird houses, some of them. And then they just put the books in there, and people walk by and take them. I think I might do one. You know, I'm a real bookaholic. We have about 2,000 books, and we need to, it's hard to part with them, but we need to let them go, and it's better to keep it, as you're saying, kind of a circle of generosity. Keep it moving. You know, we've bought them, we read them, or we'll never read them, so pass them on, let someone else enjoy them.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking about too. When I asked my kids for Christmas a couple years ago to make me one of those boxes, one of those libraries. But the other thing that I hadn't really thought about is how much it sparks all these community conversations. You know, because people are always have something to talk about. You know, what book did they find, or what book are they giving up? And you know, and it's just a really fun way to get conversations going.
Oh, that sounds really great. Now, you write eloquently in Sustainable Happiness about how turning away from excess consumerism brings greater joy and freedom. So how do we begin to change our thinking and our belief systems that's been inculcated with these billions of dollars over generations now of the advertisers trying to convince us to buy stuff to be happy? How do we begin to change our thinking and belief systems away from happiness being equated with material wealth and towards happiness being in relationships and connection and generosity?
Well, I think some of it is what we were talking about earlier, is to realize you have a choice and to reflect on what has brought you personally happiness, and then also to have those conversations with people that you're in relationship with, your family, your friends, your loved ones. You know, what brings them happiness, so that you can start having a different way of thinking about, you know, how much that's about material needs and how much it's about other things. Another thing is to consider your spiritual practice, whether or not you're religious. A lot of people have found that things like mindfulness help them to experience life with more joy, just sort of appreciating the moment that they're in instead of getting distracted by fears about what might come later or worries about what already happened and what it means. It's just allowing yourself to be in the moment. And we have a chapter by a wonderful monk, Buddhist monk, Matteo Ricard, who's a French monk who works with the Dalai Lama. There's a wonderful chapter in the book about that.
Yeah.
Another thing is to consider your addictions, because, you know, a lot of us think, well, we're not addicted to anything. If you're not an alcoholic or a drug addict, you think, well, I'm not addicted to anything. But, you know, a lot of us actually are, whether it's addicted to spending time on Facebook or or addicted to some kind of unhealthy food. So addictions tend to be a thing that take us away from happiness, because we feel like we don't have a choice.
Or the addictions of being a shopaholic and loving to shop, shop, shop till you drop, or the addiction of watching too much television, which can be very seductive. So those are all things that kind of really ultimately drain our energy. At least for me, again, you know, I go shopping with my daughter, and it's really something to watch, because I do not like shopping and she loves shopping. And by the way, I think this is something where a lot of women bond, women as friends, you know, mothers and daughters, they can bond around shopping. So there's all that emotion wrapped into the buying experience also. But she gets more energized shopping. I get more de-energized shopping. So now we've worked it out. We've got, you know, a very short, I tell you, I have a little window. I can deal with shopping for 15 minutes, and then I'm done. So she's learned how to be much more focused in and out on her shopping, and I'm willing to kind of hold my nose and go in and get what we need to get and then get out.
Yes.
But you've got a lot of very specific suggestions for people of what we can do, and I love the chapter, The 10 Things That Will Make You Happy. Is it true that that is the most popular article that you've ever published in Yes Magazine?
Yeah, it sure is. Evidently, a lot of people go onto Google and just ask, what will make me happy? And this is one of the things that pops up. And I feel good about that, because these are all based on science. They're not just, you know, what does one person's experience tell us? It's really what does the research tell us.
Yeah, and I found that very compelling. So share with our listeners, what are some more? You've mentioned some of them already, but what are some of the other scientifically proven strategies that will make us happy?
Well, one of the big ones is about gratitude. So when you say thank you, when you take a moment to really think about the places, the things that you've got that you appreciate, it goes back to that thing about your grandmother told you to count your blessings. That's actually a really good idea. Some people do it by keeping a gratitude journal. So every day they just write down, you know, just spend 5 minutes or 10 minutes just writing down the things that happened to you that day, or the things you thought about that day that you're grateful for. And the
Absolutely.
Science shows that actually does make you happier.
Yeah, it really does. You train your mind to think about what you're grateful for. And, you know, Oprah says the one thing, if you were to do one thing that would change your life, it would be keep a gratitude journal. And every day just write down and focus on what you're grateful for that has happened in that day, or what you're grateful for in your life. And it's about retraining your mind to focus on the positive.
Exactly. And, you know, taking that one more step, if you write a gratitude letter, You know, you think about one person who maybe it was years ago, you know, when you were a child, or maybe it was just yesterday and it was a really small thing. But one person who did something that you appreciate, and just take the time to write them a letter and thank them. And the research shows that that brings the writer, as well as, of course, the person who gets the letter, but especially the writer, a lasting boost of well-being.
Oh, that's
one
really
of
interesting. Yep. And then, you know, one of the ten he says there is adopting a positive attitude, and even if you're a half-empty kind of person, to just train yourself to think about, well, the glass is half full, and that positive attitude itself can help you feel happier.
That's right. And again, it's like you said about sort of training your mind, training your brain. Another one is getting out and exercising. That one's, in a way, it's kind of obvious, but there's all these endorphins that are released when we exercise. And, you know, the research shows that exercise is as effective as drugs in treating depression, and you don't have all those side effects and all those expenses.
That's fantastic. Does walking count on that, or do we have to do something more vigorous?
I think it's whatever is vigorous enough to get the endorphins going. And you can tell pretty quickly if you've done, you know, if you've walked briskly for 15 minutes and you're starting to feel a little bit happier, you're probably doing the right thing.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. And then you quote a Harvard professor in here substantiating that part of what makes you happy is having meaningful goals. So the goal isn't just, I want to be a millionaire and have lots of money. The goal is, I want, you know, something meaningful in your life in terms of, I want to help somebody, or I want to make a difference in my family or my community, or in, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood. And is it true, you said this fellow is a resident professor of happiness at Harvard?
Evidently it is, yes.
That's,
I don't know,
amazing.
If he has a different title or not, but that was
Did you talk to
title.
Him?
No, I didn't personally. Jen Angel is the one who wrote this particular piece. So
Oh my goodness. I wanna find this fellow and talk to him. I think that's amazing. What a great career. I'll be the resident professor of happiness at Harvard.
Right, or the leisure studies. That was another one that I love. But they're both serious topics, because if happiness is what people hold, what is sort of held out as the carrot in front of us that we're supposed to be, you know, chasing after, how that is defined will have a lot to do with what we do individually, but also what we do as a society.
Right. And, you know, and there is this whole emerging, blossoming field of happiness studies. You know, a lot more people are getting serious about inquiring what really makes us happy, and that's where a lot of what's in your book is based on that. So I encourage our listeners to read your book, and particularly that chapter on the 10 things that'll make us happy. So I think we've covered them, and you've added more of your own, a series of actions that we can take individually to be happy, including more time in nature. And I found that an interesting one, because we tend to spend less and less time in nature. So how did you come to that, and how do you experience greater happiness yourself with more time in nature?
Well, for me, as I mentioned, I live on the Suquamish Reservation, and I'm fortunate enough to live near the water. So when I take a walk and walk down to the waterside, I almost always see some kind of a bird or animal, or the reflection of the sky and the water and the rocks underneath. There's almost always something really beautiful to look at. And if I allow myself not to be distracted by, you know, what's on my to-do list and, you know, what did I just finish doing and what am I getting ready to do, if I allow myself to actually be present in that moment and see the enormous, complex beauty and ever-changing beauty of that spot that I return to, you know, day after day for over the course of years, if I allow myself to experience that moment and that beauty, you know, I can feel my spirits lifted from that. And, you know, that's adults have all sorts of different complex things going on in our lives, and we're really busy, and we're thinking about all these different things. But if you take a look at kids, I mean, it's almost universally true that you get kids out in a playground or out in a park or out in nature, and they just have the best time. They, you know, the what we learned when we did our issue on education, the Yes Magazine issue on education last spring, and we looked at nature kindergartens, is that, you know, the problems of ADD and ADHD, you know, those problems of attention deficit just seem to evaporate when kids have a chance to be in nature and to explore all the many different qualities and facets and experiences that they can have when they're outside. So it seems to be something we're hardwired for. We evolved in natural settings. We haven't necessarily changed enough to really be happy inside of four walls all the time, you know. So
right.
I don't
no,
think it's surprising
exactly.
that we would be happier when we actually get out in nature.
Yeah, let's all build that into our New Year's resolution, spend more time in nature, and maybe take a child, you know, whether it's your own child and niece or nephew or a neighbor's child, and go for a walk in a park, or, you know, go to the beach or go climb a tree. You know, I think that's really just wonderful to have that connection. Let's talk some about the relationship between happiness and equity, because you say that if we want healthier and happier lives, we need a more equal society, and you point to research showing that wealth inequality is associated with higher levels of violence, mental illness, and homicide. So how do you see happiness being linked with greater economic equality?
Yeah, this chapter comes from an interview that my colleague Brooke Jarvis did with a researcher and author by the name of Richard Wilkinson, who is based in the United Kingdom. And what he found in his work is just as you said, those statistics seem to play out that highly unequal societies, they have this corrosive impact on the whole society, especially on trust. So the kinds of things that we come to expect, like if we're broken down by the side of the road and we need somebody to help us out, or at least to not rob us, or, you know, if we want to do a business transaction, we want to know that the person we're doing business with is basically well-meaning, you know, that so many of the different ways in which we interact with the rest of society is undermined when we have a hugely unequal society, because there's so little trust created. The second thing that tends to undermine well-being about inequality is the stress that people are constantly worried about who has more power and wealth than they do, and who and whether they're going to have they themselves are going to lose what power and wealth they have to somebody else, because the thing about a very unequal society is it's a very steep slope, so it's easy to go tumbling down like off a steep roof. Whereas if you have a more equitable society, if you have a misstep or if you lose a job or have a divorce or something, you know, one of the many things that can happen over the course of a lifetime, you're more likely to be able to recover. So there's less sort of sense of stress and fear. And so the research does back that up, that when people are in very hierarchical situations, they tend to have shorter lifespans. And interestingly, that isn't only the people at the bottom of those hierarchies who are suffering, it's also the people at the top who tend to have less quality of life and shorter life expectancy.
And I found that interesting, that the research is showing that having a more egalitarian society is actually better for all of us, not just for the poor or middle class, but also for the rich. Because as you say, the trust is higher, crime is lower, life expectancy is longer. It seems to be a good way to go.
That's right. I mean, if you just imagine, you know, if you take it to the extreme, wealthy people don't want to live in gated communities where they have to be surrounded by high walls and security guards, you know, to feel like you can't go out on the street. I mean, it's kind of an absurd way to live. And in a more equitable society, I spent some time in the northern part of Italy, which has a a very strong cooperative economy and, you know, a really good, solid middle-class existence for everyone and the sense of security that people know they're going to be okay. And there's just this sense of relaxation about that, you know, that what's more important is to find a really good restaurant, have a really good meal with your friends, and not to worry all the time about about, you know, how hard life could get, because, you know, in a more cooperative kind of an economy, everybody can be pretty sure they're going to be taken care of if they're willing to work.
Yeah, and that sounds so much better than the way we tend to do it now. And I really thought Dave Ramsey had it right with the quote in Annie Leonard's chapter there. We buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. So we can do better than that. And I was actually surprised in reading Annie Leonard's chapter there, because, you know, some of our listeners will know her for her work on the story of stuff. And, you know, the takeaway for a lot of people from the story of stuff was that it's important to be a conscious consumer and to be aware that every time we buy something, there's so much that's gone into creating something, even if it's a T-shirt. But in this chapter in your book, Annie Leonard is talking about that the change we need will not be met by consumer choices alone. I mean, yes, that's important to do, but we also must change the way government and business acts to strengthen laws and business practices that, you know, set various standards. And, you know, that ethical consumerism is about making a good choice from the menu. And we also need citizen action, which is about working to change what's on the menu. So what's your sense of this issue of both the conscious consumerism and active citizenship?
Yeah, I think I very much agree with what Annie's point is there. If you just take the example of the T-shirt that she talks about, which is made in a sweatshop in Haiti, under conditions in which these seamstresses are living really destitute lives and would like more than anything just to be able to get $5 a day for their work instead of what they're currently being paid. So that, you know, that's one way to run an economy, and it's the way that evidently the international development establishment thinks is a good way to run the economy, because you know, because that's the most efficient way to get a T-shirt made, is to pay the lowest possible wages. So that sort of institutionalizes poverty. Well, you know, Annie points out that she's got more T-shirts than she needs. So suppose we only had, you know, a quarter as many T-shirts or a tenth as many T-shirts, but each of those women could be paid four times as much or 10 times as much. You know, we don't really benefit by having all those extra T-shirts, so we don't actually need them to be produced that cheaply if it's being taken out of the potential well, you know, and the well-being of those women and their children.
And we have the fair trade movement now, where people are willing to pay a little bit more as long as they know that money is actually going to the women making the T-shirts and not just more profit for the company selling it.
That's right. So in that case, that's, you know, a place where an individual consumer choice can help. Some products you can get fair trade, and some products are not available that way. But the other place that, you know, that's not well covered in the news, and we do try to cover it at yesmagazine.org, is the whole trade agreement question. You know, we know what NAFTA did to jobs. It kind of creates this race to the bottom where the companies can move anywhere in the world to find the lowest possible pay, and they can threaten workers who are trying to start a trade union or some other means of boosting pay. They can say, well, we'll just move to Bangladesh. So that NAFTA had that sort of effect back in the 90s, and now the Obama administration is negotiating another trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that would enter into the same sort of arrangement with major Asian countries. And, you know, our friends and colleagues over in some of those countries are as opposed to those trade agreements as we are, because they basically put the profits of corporations and their freedom to move from country to country doing whatever they want above our well-being, above our ability to organize trade unions, to protect our environment, to pass local laws that might give, for example, precedence to local businesses that hire local people. So that's
right.
All long ways of saying that I agree with Annie. There's major policy changes that are needed to protect, you know, our ability to have a good life, as well as individual consumer choices. I don't think either one is going to do it alone.
Right. I agree we need both, and the major policy decision, you know, need to be changed. And at the same time, as you point out in the book, the U.S. has become an oligarchy, and the views of the people don't really influence policy as much as we would like. So what do we do about that problem where the money influence is so strong in our government that the voice of the people can be drowned out by big money?
Well, as you say, these are all interconnected issues. That's a tough one. And there's some great work being done to try to overturn the Citizens United decision, for example, the decision of the Supreme Court that opens the floodgates to any amount of money in politics. So we need to work at every level of our government to retake our democratic system, our government, back from big moneyed interests and make them once again accountable to we the people.
Right, and I think, you know, the part of what happens, the big money is in there, and yes, the candidates need money to win, but at the same time, the reason candidates need money is because they want to get the votes, and if people get informed and engaged, then the people power can overtake the money power. So
that's right.
As long as we're engaged citizens. But I do, you mentioned that trade. I'm very concerned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership coming up, particularly with the Republicans taking over the House and the Senate in January. And it was a question that came to me in reading your book. You know, that what's happening now economically seems to be kind of a natural development of capitalism. Do you think that capitalism is compatible with happiness for the majority of people?
It depends on how you define capitalism. If you define it as the kind of system we have now with giant corporations and huge, powerful Wall Street banks who are getting to set the terms of how government works and the rules and where production takes place and where jobs are shut down, no, I don't think it's compatible with that kind of big, multinational, transnational corporate capitalism. I don't think that's compatible. If you talk about capitalism in terms of a market economy with small businesses, locally based, locally rooted companies that have everything from mom and pop to, you know, municipally owned to cooperative to, you know, small regional businesses, and if you have a democratic system that's able to put some parameters around how that economy works so that it doesn't destroy the environment, for example, for future generations, then I think it is compatible.
Very good. And part of it is, you know, we get what we measure, and we've been measuring our economic prosperity by the gross domestic product. And you rightly say there's flaws in that and propose that we use the genuine progress indicator. Can you explain for our listeners very briefly what's wrong with the GDP and why you selected the genuine progress indicator as a way of measuring prosperity?
Sure. The GDP measures how much cash changes hands. But as I was mentioning earlier, if that cash changes hands because people are sick, because they're eating poisoned food, or if it changes hands because the divorce rate goes up because people don't have any time to spend with their spouses, the economy treats all those as good things, because more money is being spent and more divorce lawyers are being hired. The genuine progress indicator measures things like health and life expectancy and the environmental quality. So it measures things that people can agree indicate that our lives are going well. And so if we measure that instead, we might say, wow, our economy is growing, but we're not any better off. What if we designed our policies instead to make us better off instead of to just make sure more cash is changing hands?
Yes, and I was encouraged to see that genuine progress indicator is now being used in Vermont and Maryland, so we're making some progress. So that's all the time we have, but if listeners want to read your book, they can go to the yesmagazine.org website, is that right?
That's correct. It'll be in bookstores beginning the 1st of January, but right now we're giving Yes Magazine readers and friends a preview chance at buying it on our website at yesmagazine.org.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for a wonderful book, and that's all the time we have. Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Many thanks to our research assistant, Dr. Judith Singleton. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's